This is CS455 on September 25th. Maybe an important one, so try to get that out. All right, so next time is the exam on Monday. And it'll be here in this room, you know, the usual thing. Several people in the class have DRC accommodations. It will be helpful to me if you would email me reminding me of that ahead of time, and especially let me know if you need to take it at the DRC center. For people who just need extra time, we can have the exam in here and then move to another room. We can't stay here, but we'll go ahead and move to another room if that's okay with you, or you're also welcome to take it at the DRC. So just let me know what you need in that way, but let me know before Sunday night so I can get things arranged in time for class. Okay, that was that. So the exam is closed book, closed notes, closed computer. You may use a calculator, although I don't give problems that should require calculators. You know, they should be straightforward. But you got to keep track of the decimal place. Refer to the class calendar for topics, and then today we're going to go through and I'm going to walk through some of the review questions from the book that are relevant. I don't think we're actually going to cover any new material today, but if we do, it won't be on the exam. It sort of depends on how many questions there are before we finish. There is a sample exam posted on today's slot in the calendar. Don't take it as a study guide. Any one exam just covers a very small slice of what it is that we've covered. So you really need to pay attention to what the review questions are that I talk about today and use those as your study guide instead. But the sample exam does give you a sense of sort of the format of the exam and how I tend to ask questions. So before I start in and start going through the review questions, any questions from you? This stage. Okay. So for chapter one, we had an assignment, and I circled sort of a lot of the problems there. So it should be clear what I have in mind there from that problem set. Chapter 2, which is the application layer, deals with stuff like... let me just go through what the review questions are that I picked out as being particularly relevant. So this is having to do with the application layer. There are two sets of problems, remember, at the back of each chapter, or at least two sets, maybe three. There are the R questions, review questions, the P questions, which are problems, and then I think there's some implementation questions, but we won't do any of those. So, chapter two, review question eight was very relevant. Four broad classes of service that transport protocols can provide. Indicate whether UDP or TCP provides that class of service. Right? So that's a good review question. Similarly, review question 11, why do HTTP, FTP, SMTP, and POP3 run on top of TCP rather than on UDP? Right? It's, number 11. Right? That gets to the same issue. What are the services that a protocol like that requires that's provided by UDP or TCP. We talked about web caching, and review question 13 pertains to that. why does caching work, basically? And then I also expect you to know the formula for determining the benefit associated with caching based on the relative performance of the cached version and the uncached version and the hit rate, also known as the, well, not known as the miss rate, but related to the miss rate. Okay, and review question 27. A UDP server needs only one socket. A TCP server uses two sockets. Why? All right. Okay. So think about that question. And that should sort of be apparent from the programming that you're working on now as well, why the TCP server needs two sockets. Good. Then from the problem section in chapter 2, there is problem 1. I thought problem 1b was particularly relevant. Two distinct web pages can be sent over the same persistent TCP connection. Okay. Should know how to figure that out. Okay, problem 3 is concerned with what protocols are involved in fetching a web page, right? We have, of course, HTTP for retrieving the web page itself, but think about what else is required. We put in the URL, the address of the server. We typically don't put in the address. We put in a name. So what does that imply about what other protocols are involved in fetching a web page? Really, I didn't circle any of those. Ah, yeah, there we go. Problem 34 asks you to install and compile some example programs from the book's website, a TCP client and a UDP client and server. TCP and UDP clients and servers. You don't have to do that, I think, in order to answer the questions, if you think about it. The relevant questions are, what happens if you start a TCP client before you run the corresponding server that it wants to attach to? Okay. What is the behavior that is seen in that case? And then similarly, what happens if you start a UDP client before you start the corresponding server? What behavior will you see in that case? Okay. It'll be different. And why, right? Why is that behavior different? I mean, if you understand those differences in behavior, then you understand something about how those protocols work. Let's put it the other way around. If you understand something about how those protocols work, then you'll understand the differences between those two things. Okay. Questions about the application layer and its review?
So there's only 6 questions we should be looking at as well as reviewing the entire section?
Yes. Yeah. Those were the particular ones that chapter. For chapter 1, of course, you have the exercises that you did. Okay, so chapter 3 then, we did not get to the congestion control part in detail, although you should definitely understand the difference between flow control associated with making sure that the sender doesn't overrun the receiver, and congestion control, which is about making sure that the sender sort of is well behaved in the global network along with all the other senders. So that's the limit of the understanding on congestion control that I'm going to be looking for. This time we'll save the detailed congestion control stuff for next time. Okay, so for me, it seemed there was a lot more meat in this chapter, so I've got a lot more questions for you to look at. Another thought about chapter 2. Oh, yes. Chapter 2. And this is also in the sample exam. So this is one instance where the sample exam is a good study guide. You remember I said it's really important to know the order of the system calls in the standard patterns for client and servers using sockets. So there's one version of that question in the sample exam. I have others. If you know the order, you'll have no problem with any of the forms of the question. If you don't know the order, any of them could be problematic. Okay. Yes?
This might be a little awkward, but for like the homework assignment we're doing, like our project, is there anything really relevant about that homework assignment that we should know? For the exam, obviously, it's like get those by names and right. That's fine. But is there something else that anything relevant to that project?
I don't think so. I mean, this is a networking class, not a sort of system programming class, so issues about buffering behavior of standard output and other things that people trip over are not really on the table for the exam. They are something you have to cope with in the project. Okay. So, review question, this is chapter 3 now. Review question 3, it's a question about port numbers on a connection between two hosts and how they're used. Okay, so take a look at that. It should be it's a pretty simple answer. Review question 4 sort of comes back to the issues that were thought about in Chapter 2, and asks why an application developer might choose to run an application over UDP rather than TCP. So it's very similar to that other review question from Chapter 2. Review question 6. Is it possible for an application to enjoy reliable data transfer even when the application runs over UDP? Let's talk about that one. Let's dive into that one a little bit. Is it possible for an application to have reliable data transfer over UDP? Yes. How?
Emulate TCP.
Yeah, essentially implement reliable data transfer in some way on its own. Okay. Good. Okay. Review question 7 talks about UDP sockets and data transfer between two sending hosts and a receiving host using a particular port number. The question here is making sure that you understand what the mapping is between information in an incoming data packet and the socket that it gets delivered to. See what I mean? So we talked about in TCP how that mapping is based on the host and destination addresses as well as the host and destination port numbers, right? That you have to get a match on all four of those to get to the right socket. But with UDP, you don't have that behavior. Instead, did that just turn off? Oh, no, it didn't. Here. Projector didn't turn off. Just the computer. Okay, so this is review question 7. And the other question to think about in this context is, for TCP, we've been using the send and receive system calls to send data, right? We haven't really done much with UDP yet, but the question is, suppose a application receives a message over a UDP socket and now wants to reply to the sender of that message. Okay? I haven't talked about this, but it's worth pointing out at this point. How is it going to find out who it should reply to? Well, it's got to get some information from the system call that it uses to receive the message. And in fact, there is a different system call for that purpose called receive message, RECVMSG. Okay? And in addition to actually returning the data, it returns a struct sock adder that contains the address of the socket that sent that message. Okay? And there's a corresponding system call called send message that takes directly a struct sock adder to address the reply. Okay? So you have to do this with UDP because you don't have a connection, right? In TCP, you've got all this stuff set up, these mappings of addresses and sockets, you got that set up in the listen and bind and connect process. But in UDP, you don't do that. So there has to be a way to pass the addresses back and forth, and the answer is send message and receive message. Review question 8. Again, just making sure that you understand how this mapping between address information in the packets and sockets works. Okay, so that was the end of the socket mapping stuff. Review question 9 talks about why we need sequence numbers for reliable data transfer, and what is the purpose of the timers that are involved in those. Why do we need them? What is the problem that they solve? Often an excellent way to understand a feature of a protocol or an interface is to say, why is that there? What problem does it solve? Okay. Review question 12 just urges you to install a applet for go back in and observe its behavior. That would be a good thing to do. Review question 13 does the same thing with a selective repeat applet. I think running those applets a little bit and playing around with them will help illustrate their behavior. That would be good. Okay, section 3.5, review question 14, a bunch of true or false questions. So understand those. Review question 15. Okay. So remember when I said that an excellent exam question is to draw one of those diagrams with the arrows on it and sequence numbers and ACT numbers on it and leave out some of the sequence numbers and ACT numbers and ask you to fill them in? Well, that's what question 15 is about, although it doesn't present it in that form. It says, but it's the same knowledge. Okay, so puzzle that one out. Okay, so continuing on to the P problems now, problem 2 again is about IP addresses and how they're used in network layer datagrams and transport layer segments. Okay, problem 5. This is interesting. This is a question about the checksums that occur in UDP and TCP packets, and let's just discuss this. So remember that a checksum is computed by creating a 16-bit value by adding up all the 16-bit values that occur in the packet, right? And then doing some sort of manipulation on it. That doesn't matter for this question. The question here is, suppose that the checksum is equal to the expected value. So we have the checksum field in the received packet, and we do the computation on the data, and we get the right answer. Okay? Question is, do we know that the packet is uncorrupted? No. Why not? Pardon? It could be off in some way that doesn't change the checksum, right? And if you think about it, it has to be that way, unless the packet only has 16 bits of data in it. Because if it were any other way, it would mean that you could represent all the information that was in the packet in 16 bits. You'd have a compression algorithm that could take an arbitrarily large packet and turn it into 16 bits. No. We'll talk more about this when we talk about link layers and various checksum algorithms and what they're actually capable of detecting or not. But anyway, it's a good thing to think about. Okay, problem 14. So this is about window sizes and channel utilization. Remember in the diagrams that we drew, we showed that, for example, if you do a stop and wait algorithm, you send for a little bit and then you wait for a long time and you have low channel utilization. And in order to get complete channel utilization, you have to be able to send lots of unacknowledged data. And that means the receiver has to have a big enough window size to allow the sender to send that data. This question asks you, this question asks you to compute the size of the window that's required. And the way to think about that is think about how big is a bit on the wire. How long is it? How many meters long, essentially? And given that, and given the length of the channel in meters, you can figure out how many bits it takes to fill up that channel, right? That's and if you play with those equations a little bit, you soon come to the conclusion that what you're really interested in is the product of the bandwidth and the delay. That will tell you how many bits you need to fill up the channel. Although, one thing to watch out for there is make sure you understand whether we're talking about the one-way delay or the round-trip delay. Right? It sometimes there's a factor of two in those calculations. Problem 15 is again about channel utilization and computation of channel utilization for a stop and wait protocol. Problem 19 is just making sure you understand that what sequence numbers can be occurring at what time in a protocol. And just work through that. That should be easy. Problem 23 is again about differences in services between TCP and UDP. Why does an application have more control over the data that is sent in a particular segment when using UDP than it does when using TCP? Let's talk about that one. Why does the application have greater control over what's in a segment when using UDP, a transmitted segment?
Just less header information?
No.
Because TCP is a stream, so it will, or it may, collect multiple packets into a single packet.
You bet. You bet. TCP is a stream-oriented protocol. It's the only guarantees it's making is to get the bytes there in order. And it's free to chop them up any way it likes while doing that. The second part of this question was, why does an application have more control over when the segment is sent? Same difference, right? TCP has sort of complete control over what things it puts together, what things it chops apart, when it sends them, when it doesn't. UDP, when you say send a message, that's the message that's going to be sent, and it's going to be sent as soon as possible on the available link. Problem 29, estimating round trip times, exponential averaging, simple algebra. And then I think the remaining questions are about congestion control, so we won't do those. Okay? So, any questions on your part at this point? No? Yes. Right. There won't be, you know, apart from the what order do the system calls happen in, there isn't any coding on this. And even that one I usually phrase not as code up, but tell me what order things happen in, or write in, fill in the blanks in the right order, or some such thing. Okay? Yeah, this is not primarily a programming class. Go ahead.
So one other thing, are most of these just kind of like a short answer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, short answer, sometimes multiple choice, sometimes true and false. Sometimes, you know, I sometimes write questions that require two or three sentences to answer, but not... You know, it's not going to be a two-page essay either. That doesn't seem like the right way to get at your understanding of this material. Okay. Well then, I guess I will start in on the congestion control material. So I think what we'll do today, yeah.
And one other thing for
sure.
The program. Earlier, one of the class sheets said something about write and read and send and receive.
Uh-huh.
Are those basically the same, or do you better use send and receive?
It's probably better to use send and receive just so you're sort of used to using send and receive. But when you use send and receive with the last argument zero, which is the flags argument, that's completely equivalent to read and write. Okay, it's just that send and receive have that extra last argument that lets you exercise greater control, but we're not using it. Okay. Fine. Okay, congestion control. So remember the issue here is how does a TCP connection behave in such a way that it best protects the ability of the network to serve its clients. Right? It's not no longer about so much the behavior of this connection in isolation, but rather this connection in respect of other things that are going on. So in order to understand that, we sort of have to understand what we mean by congestion. Basically, too much data in the network. That's the main issue. It shows up, congestion shows up as lost packets, that is packets that get sent but are never delivered, and long delays. And the lost packets happens when buffers are full, and long delays happen when buffers are not so full that they have to drop things, but rather they're so full that things wait a long time before they proceed. Throughout, you know, the author has been identifying things as top 10 problems. These are sort of the fundamental issues in networking that people have worked on over the last 30 years to try to solve as best as they can, and still receive attention today. Okay, so to illustrate this situation, we have an example where two hosts are sending to two other hosts, and they're sharing some common resource that is not fast enough to let them both go at flat out speed. The behavior that's seen in that case is characterized by two things. One is, on this left graph, we're looking at the throughput of the system as a whole. And it looks pretty good, right? It says I got to say one other thing. Lambda in networking is typically used as a sending rate. So it'll be measured in bytes per second. Or bits per second. Okay, so the throughput observation here is that as we increase the sending rate of each receiver, the behavior we'd like to see is that the output rate, that is what comes out the other side of this limiting channel, just increases along with the input rate, right? That's what you'd like to see. The unfortunate thing is that when the input rates of the two senders are not constant, but rather probabilistic. So if the two senders are each sending at rate capacity over 2, and that's just what they're doing, they just do that constantly, then we'll be okay. But if the two senders are sending with average rate capacity over 2, sometimes going faster and sometimes going slower, the discipline of queuing theory says that, in fact, as you get up to capacity over 2 average on each of the two, the delays go to infinity. Right? So you can't get too close to the capacity without getting large delays. Okay? So that's a manifestation of congestion. But notice that the throughput remains okay, right? That you're still getting capacity over 2 sort of delay. All right. Well, in fact, delays can't go to infinity. Infinities require infinite resources. So what happens instead is that there's a finite buffer here. Rather than getting up to infinite delay, what we start seeing is that some packets arrive here to find the buffer full, and then they get dropped. Okay, and that's how you get lost packets. And unfortunately, if you're coupling this with a reliable data transfer scenario, that means that the sender of that dropped packet is going to have to figure out that it was dropped and resend it. And that means that network resources up here, prior to the drop point, become more congested and less usefully used because the sender is now having to send stuff that, right, is... The sender is sending stuff through these early parts of the network that's now getting dropped here and serving no useful purpose. Yeah, this is why I didn't really want to do this today. Because this slide is a mess. It didn't translate well from PowerPoint to OpenOffice. So I think I will stop there until I can redo the slide, because it's going to be really hard to make out what's going on here with little dribbles and strabbles of ink spread over the page. So any other questions about... Yeah. What are the main bottlenecks? The main bottleneck today is probably much more at the edges of the network than in the center. You see this, you personally experience this by having to pay lots of money for high bandwidth connections to the internet. Okay. And in this country, we have much less penetration of high bandwidth internet services to homes than they do in some other countries. Partly that's because we're a very spread out country. We tend to live in suburban and rural environments much more than people in other countries do, where it's a lot easier to deliver high-speed internet service to a high-rise apartment building than it is to deliver it to you know, a couple square miles of Pullman. And so, yeah, Sean?
If we have questions on the review of the weekend, can you reach us at all?
Send me emails. Maybe. I'm usually around. So be happy to reply if I can. So please remind me about extra time accommodations, and I will plan accordingly.